Let's talk about a magic number in American politics, 435. That's the number of seats in the U.S. House of Representatives. That's been the number for over 100 years. With one little brief wiggle when Alaska and Hawaii became states, we quickly resettled on 435. But the population of the U.S. has gone up over that time from 92 million in 1910 to 331 million in the latest census. So congressional districts have gotten a lot larger. A bill in Congress would boost the number of representatives. Democratic Representative Earl Blumenauer of Oregon wants to add 150 seats after the next census and some more after that. It's not likely to pass, but why have we settled on 435? Is it worth adding some seats? Want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Is it time to embiggen the House of Representatives? What do you like or not like about that idea? And do you have questions about why things are the way they are? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Stephen Smith joins us now. He's the Kate M. Gregg Distinguished Professor of Social Sciences and Professor of Political Science at Washington University. He's written a number of books on American politics and Congress. Steve, welcome back to the show.
Great to be with you.
Let's start at the beginning. What does the Constitution say about how we figure out how many representatives we have?
Well, it leaves most of this to Congress, but it says that every 10 years we have a census. The Constitution requires that decennial census, and it requires then that representatives in the House of Representatives be apportioned to the states in a fashion that reflects that most recent census. Then it says that no state shall have more than one representative for every 30,000 people, and each state gets at least one representative, that is, whatever its size. So the Constitution was, of course, written at a time when we had maybe up to 13 states, and 30,000 seemed to be about the right number. It created a House of Representatives in the first Congress with 65 members.
I ran the numbers. If we did 30,000 per district now, we'd have a Congress, a House of just over 11,000 representatives. Seems a little unwieldy.
Yeah, that's right.
Now, this was this ran into controversy pretty early on. You wrote on your Substack a while back that even the founders kind of disagreed over how to implement that basic guideline in the Constitution.
Well, they sure did. 30,000 is a nice round number, but it hardly ever divides evenly into the size of a state's population. So from the very beginning, the contending forces in American politics argued about how to deal with fractions. Alexander Hamilton had one point of view. Thomas Jefferson had another point of view. At the start, Congress adopted the Hamilton version, which basically said that if your state has the largest fraction, you get the next representative, and so on. Jefferson had a somewhat different formula. Turned out that President George Washington agreed with Jefferson and cast his very first veto of that congressional legislation, which was then written with the Jefferson plan, a somewhat more complicated plan, in mind. Politics was central to this from the start because the Jefferson plan allowed Virginia to get one more representative under his plan than under the Hamilton plan. And politics has infused the decision about what method to use for apportioning districts to states ever since.
Now, before we dig into the argument of whether to go past 435, why did we lock in just over a century ago on this magic number, 435?
For politics again. Early in the century, in the late 19th century and early 20th century, the United States was growing very rapidly. We had a very large number of immigrants. There was a fairly large transfer of Americans, especially Black Americans, from the South to the North. And this filled northern urban areas, which became more and more industrial. And so the population became more and more northern and industrial. Republicans and rural political interests disliked this change and thought that reapportioning seats or continuing to increase the number of seats in the House of Representatives would only give a bigger and bigger advantage to the North. So what happened was they decided first not to reapportion and not to increase or change the size of the House. Between 1789 and 1910, the House had increased in size every 10 years as the country grew.
We're talking to Steve Smith from Washington University about the idea of increasing the size of the U.S. House of Representatives. Now, one argument that made by the sponsor of this bill I mentioned and others is, okay, 1910, again, I checked the numbers, it was about 200,000 people per district. You have a chart on that Substack article I mentioned. Now we're knocking on the door of 800,000. So four times as many people represented by this same number of Congress folks in effect. Does this make them in some way less representative, do you think?
Well, that certainly is the primary argument for increasing the size of the House. Right now, the average district size is about 765,000, and we're going to be reaching a million here in a couple of decades. So if you think that having some personal contact with your legislator is important, and that the lower house, the House of Representatives of Congress, is the one place in federal government where you can have that, then you'd have to admit that having districts that approach a million are just way too large for having that kind of contact. Of course, the geographic size of districts really is not changing because we have not added states and states are not growing geographically. But the mix of political and economic and social interests in states and districts, of course, become more complex. And there's a good argument that a representative cannot get to know those people and those interests when those districts' populations are so large.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Nick is with us in Green Bay. Nick, hi.
Hi, thank you. I'm so happy to hear this topic. It's something I agree with. I'd love to see a more significant increase. The question I have is, if we increase the amount of representatives, thereby lowering the population that each representative represents, does that make it more difficult to gerrymander legislative districts?
Well, interesting question, Nick. What do you think, Steve?
Well, the gerrymandering, of course, is a function of state politics. And I will trust my state politicians to continue to pursue their partisan and political interests, no matter how many seats there are assigned to a state. So I don't think it gets rid of gerrymandering. There's plenty of gerrymandering already in state legislative contests or seats. So I'd expect congressional gerrymandering to continue. Now it does mean that it might be a little bit easier to draw some district lines. And to keep districts looking kind of normal, where they're not odd shapes, where all the parts of the district are sort of contiguous to each other. Certainly easier to get around those districts. But the gerrymandering, I don't think that'll end.
Thanks a lot for that call, Nick, at 800-642-1234. Steve, what would have to happen to increase the size of the House? There's a bill. Does that mean this is just normal legislation, if somehow it passed Congress, signed by the president, boom, we've got more representatives?
Yeah. It's not any more complicated than that. During the period between 1789 and the 19 teens, Congress every 10 years would revisit this question and would take into account the expected growth in population. And set a new number that reflected that growth. It was regular legislation. Now, there were politics to that legislation, as you can imagine. It wasn't always easy to get that legislation enacted. Partisan divisions between the House and the Senate and the president oftentimes got in the way. But yes, that's all it takes is a regular piece of legislation signed by the president.
Talking to Steve Smith from Washington University, looking at the U.S. House of Representatives, why it has exactly 435 members, even as the U.S. population keeps growing, and the pros and cons of a proposed law, a long shot, that would add a bunch of seats to the House. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Should we add seats to the House of Representatives? What do you think the benefits could be? What worries would you have? What questions do you have about the political impact and some of the history behind this? You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. We continue our talk with political scientist Steve Smith from Washington University in St. Louis, looking at a bill in Congress that would add 150 seats to the U.S. House of Representatives. It's a long shot, it looks like. We're finding out why the House has stuck with 435 seats for over 100 years, even as the population has grown a lot. You can join in with your thoughts on the issue at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Steve, I assume, like, if I'm a member of a political party, I would worry that increasing the number of members of the House, you know, will it hurt my side or help my side? Big states, small states might ask the same kind of questions. Who potentially could win or lose by increasing the size of the House?
Well, that's a good question, and the answer is just a little complicated. Obviously, the most obvious interest at stake is the interest of the very smallest states. You know, Wyoming, with roughly 550,000 people, gets one representative, even though the average size of a House district is now approaching 770,000. So a state like Wyoming will lose arithmetically. Its one representative will end up becoming a smaller fraction of the total House if the large states gain a lot more seats as the overall size of the House increases. So there would be some opposition, I think, from small states. But you can imagine these new districts would be much smaller. So it's likely, for example, that the district lines would line up with local units of government, like county or city lines, a little bit better than they do now. It's possible that we'll have more districts that are really dominated by some minority interest. We'll have more Black districts. We'll have more Latino districts. And it could be that in some of these districts, a third or a fourth party, a minor party, might actually be more popular than the two major parties. So as you shrink those districts, it creates the possibility that these geographically concentrated interests in our politics will gain some formal representation in Congress, and the major parties might not like that. And of course, there are the current incumbents in the House of Representatives. They might prefer to be one of 435 than one of, say, 650. So their power would be diluted. And of course, in order to get the bill passed, we have to get a majority of those incumbent members to support the idea. So there's all kinds of sources of opposition, but many sources of support for this kind of thing.
Let's bring in another caller now. Jeff is with us in West Salem. Jeff, hi.
Yes, good afternoon. I would just like to bring up the fact that the general public should be getting the same benefits as far as health care and et cetera that the House of Representatives gets. And if you add another 150 House members, that's going to be a heck of a zap to the budget, if you ask me.
Jeff, thanks for the call. The cost of not just the members of the House, but the additional staff per member of House, Steve.
Oh, sure. Yeah, there are real costs to doing this. But, you know, to be honest, the cost of running Congress, while a substantial sum of money, is peanuts in comparison with the size of the federal budget. So I don't think that can be our dominant concern. I think we have to worry about the quality of our democracy first, and when we decide what's best for the democracy, we ought to be willing to pay for it. But there are a number of considerations. The House chamber is already bursting at the seams. Individual, members there do not get individual seats or desks. They just crowd into the chamber. they have office space. Perhaps you know, an additional office building would have to be put up. And as you say, they need to be staffed if they're going to do a good job of their representation. So sure, there are real costs. There's no doubt about that.
Thanks for the call. One thing we don't talk much, Steve, about the job of being in Congress or on a congressional staff is constituent services, which is a lot of things. And I have seen concerns that given the size of the districts, the population of districts, I should say, that are being represented, that they're just overwhelmed. Can you talk about that side of the job that isn't always in the limelight?
Well, that's right. On Capitol Hill, it's usually called casework. It's where a constituent brings a personal problem, oftentimes with an executive or a federal agency. Maybe they want their son or daughter to get early release from the armed services because a parent recently passed away, and the family farm would go under if they don't get more help. A member of Congress might be called in to help them make the arrangements. Or someone has a problem with their Social Security check. They have someone on Capitol Hill to go to. Members of Congress spend a lot of time doing that. And they are struggling with this because their staffs have been essentially capped in size. The office budgets really have not grown much now for a couple of decades. And so personal staff has been pretty well fixed, even though the size of the population and the amount of casework they're expected to do has increased. Increase the number of members, it is certainly the case that constituents would have better access to members and their staff. And depending upon how much staff support we allow members of Congress to have, it could very well be that casework service will be improved.
Let's go back to our callers now. Dennis is with us in Two Rivers. Dennis, hi.
Hi, I was just wondering about if your plan might include having districts cross state borders. So maybe you follow the population instead of just figuring, okay, well, we have to cut it off here because the state border is here.
Dennis, thanks for the call. As I understand it, Steve, we can't do that.
Well, not according to the Constitution. We can amend the Constitution, but that's a mighty lift. The Constitution does allocate House seats to the states. How the states choose to elect them is pretty much up to them, subject to quite a variety of federal and court regulations. You know, there is another kind of twist to this. The current interest in increasing the size of the House stems in part from a group of reformers who would like to see the House move to proportional representation. So that the parties received seats in the House within a state in proportion to the number of votes they received. Supporters of proportional representation would like to increase the number of seats. Wisconsin has 10 seats, but if Wisconsin, say, had 15 seats, it could divide those seats among more parties or more directly in proportion to the votes. So there is a kind of a hidden agenda, actually not so hidden, among some reformers who would like to see us move to proportional representation and have the membership of the House then better reflect the proportionate support for the parties in the general public.
One quick clarification, 10 electoral votes in Wisconsin, 8 congressional seats.
Ten electoral votes, yeah, sorry.
Which brings me to, if we change the number of representatives, that affects the Electoral College, right?
Well, it would. If the Electoral College constitutional provisions were not changed, increasing the number of seats in the House would automatically increase the number of electoral votes that a state would receive. Now, remember, the seats in the House would still be allocated to the states, apportioned to the states according to their population. So the relative balance in the Electoral College across the states wouldn't change a lot. The one change that's obvious is for the very smallest states, which receive 3 electoral votes, one for their representative and one for each of their 2 senators. So they get 3 no matter their size. That might still be the case, but 3, if we increase the size of the House, 3 would be a smaller part of the whole.
And briefly, Steve, hey, what about the Senate? That's, 2 per state as things stand right now. Anybody thinking about changing that in any way?
Well, people think about it, but then they read the Constitution and they see that it provides for two senators per state. And then the Article 5 actually says you can't even amend that. Well, there's some legal dispute about whether it's truly unamendable, but it's pretty clear that it would be far, far tougher to change the membership of the Senate than the membership of the House.
Steve, we'll leave it there. Thanks, as always, for joining us today.
Oh, great to be with you. Have a good day.
You too. That's Stephen Smith, professor of social sciences and political science at Washington University in St. Louis. He joined us for a look at the size of the House of Representatives and what it would take to add more members to the House. There's still time for you to weigh in on that idea. Do you think the House of Representatives needs to be bigger so that district sizes, populations are smaller? Do you think that would make things more representative? Or do you worry about the impact of something like that? Let us know what you think over on the Ideas Network Facebook page.